Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. For some time now, women have been well represented in certain areas of the life sciences, such as genetics, cell biology, and biochemistry. In fact, women make up more than half of all biology grad students and 40% of biology postdocs.
But something happens on the way to those coveted university professorships. The number of women in the life sciences plummets dramatically. Only 18% of tenured biology professors are female. And that's true right across the other science disciplines as well. So what happens? Well, some clues emerged today in the pages of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which published a study on the gender gap in the nation's research labs. The study is co-authored by Jason Schelzer. He's a biology grad student at MIT, and he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you studied 2,000 of the top biology labs in the country. They're sort of feeders for tenure-track professorships. What did you find?
So while women are very well represented across all labs in biology, when we started breaking it down and looking at specific subsets, specifically subsets of labs run by men, we found a very different picture.
Okay, and what was so specifically different about it then?
In labs run by male Nobel laureates, male grad students outnumbered female grad students by about 2 to 1. In labs run by male Nobel laureates, male postdocs outnumbered female postdocs by about 3 to 1.
Okay, and you didn't see that same discrepancy in elite labs run by women?
Labs run by elite women, women who had won the Nobel Prize, been elected to the National Academy, hired just as many women as was representative of the pool of trainees.
Okay, and how does this compare to, those are the elite labs, the very top level cutting edge research labs across the country. How does this compare to the many thousands of other labs who don't occupy that top niche?
So one thing that's very important about these top labs is these are the labs where the next generation of faculty members train. We found that people who worked in National Academy labs, who worked for Nobel laureates at the postdoctoral stage, were much more likely to be hired for a faculty position. So the fact that there are so few female students in these labs has reverberations across the academic ecosystem.
Okay, so you're a biology grad student at MIT right now.
I am.
I mean, is this something... MIT has come a long way in the past several years in terms of the representation of women on its faculty, but is this something that you're still seeing?
I think that, unfortunately, it's still the case at places like Harvard and MIT as well.
Okay, because I read that you an anecdote that you shared with another media outlet about the fact that you had a friend or you ran into a woman who was a physics postdoc?
She was a physics grad student at Princeton.
And she was telling you how she was the first grad student to join a particular lab that she was going to join, first female grad student in, what, like 20 years or something?
Yep. Yeah, it's astounding, the records that some faculty members have.
Okay, so here comes the correlation-causation question. Do you have any sense, did your research reveal why there's this dearth of women in the elite labs in the life sciences?
So our research was just a snapshot of biology labs as they exist today. We can't really get to the causality question, but I think that some important factors could be potentially self-selection among female grad students towards or away from certain labs, and also conscious or unconscious bias on the part of some male faculty members.
Okay, so two very deep veins to mine there. So Jason Schelzer, stand by for just a moment because I want to bring in an experienced voice in this matter. Nancy Hopkins, she's a molecular biologist and professor emerita at MIT. She's a member of the National Academy of Sciences and for many years did some very cutting-edge research on zebrafish and cloning vertebrate developmental genes using those zebrafish as a model. Nancy Hopkins, welcome to you.
Hello, thank you.
So first of all, I wonder if I could just pick up where Jason left off and ask you, why do you think it's important to recognize that there is a dearth of women in the nation's elite laboratories?
Well, for exactly the reasons that Jason said, and he said it, I think, extremely well, this is these people are training the next generation of science professors and leaders in science in the biological field. So if they're missing from those labs, they'll be missing from the next generation of faculty and leaders.
Mm. Well, I noted, though, in the introduction to you that you used zebrafish as a model for your studies of developmental genes. And I was wondering if it might be all right to use your own personal career as a model for this perplexing problem regarding gender in the life sciences, because I was reading that when you were younger as an undergrad at Radcliffe, for many years, you didn't even think about going into the sciences until you ran into a very particular professor, none other than James Watson, one of the most important scientists of the 20th century.
Right, absolutely. So I know firsthand how important it is to come out of the lab of a person like that. You know, I started at the top, and Jim Watson encouraged me to be a scientist. And I wanted to be a scientist, but as a very young person, it's hard to imagine yourself as a professor at a place like MIT or Harvard.
Right.
You don't know if you have the ability, and you know, very few people do this, and certainly in my generation, almost none. But if Jim Watson tells you you've got the right stuff and you should do it, and he pushes you to do it, that's going to shape your life and shape mine.
Yes, but Professor Hopkins, if I may ask, I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that you basically saw a lecture that Jim Watson gave. And for listeners who don't remember, he was the co-discoverer of the structure of DNA. And then you went to his lab and basically asked him as an undergrad if you could work for him. And he said yes. Is that right?
That's correct.
So I'm asking you that because of what Jason said, that he wonders if there continues to be a self-selection problem amongst up-and-coming women scientists, female scientists, when it comes to getting into those elite labs. I mean, your example says that, you know, maybe if you ask and you're qualified, you're going to get in.
I think he put forward the two possibilities. It's self-selection by the women, and the other is that it's biased by the men. And, you know, Jim was very young, and Watson, he was 35 years old. He was open to all kinds of possibilities. Molecular biology was a young field. He was an unusual person. But there were men whose labs I think I would not have approached because I think I would have known that they would not be receptive. I can't even explain how women know these things, but to some extent they do.
Mm.
But I think, you know, my one case that took place 50 years ago, literally, I heard Jim Watson speak 50 years ago, is very different from what's going on here today, where there are so many women in the biology pipeline, but as Jason said, they're not getting to the top. And he's identified, he and Joan, his co-author, have identified a potentially profoundly important reason why.
Mm-hmm. And just forgive me, but there's just one more question about James Watson and his influence on your career itself that I'd love to ask, because, I mean, he later on became famous not only for his, you know, revolutionary science, but also for the fact that he was seen as somewhat prickly, imperious, and at times communicated not the most positive attitude about women in science in general. Did you ever encounter that when you were a young woman working in his lab?
I didn't encounter it when I was young, and I think that this is another complexity of this problem. I think that when women are students, they're not really competing with men who are powerful on an equal level. They're young, they're vulnerable, somebody has to take care of them. And faculty, there are fortunately some faculty men who will take on students, and I think more frequently they take on graduate students, but it's when, as the women rise in their careers, what we found is that's when they encounter these problems.
Mm.
So young people think, gosh, I'm not having a problem. This problem must have been solved in some previous generation. Then as they age through their careers, they hit the problem at a later stage too.
Right. Well, Jason Shelter, let me bring you back in here because so we talked a little bit about the possibility of the self-selection issue when it comes to women and their opportunities in the nation's elite biology labs. But what about the other half of the problem that you talked about, and that is sort of persistent, perhaps unconscious attitudes amongst the men who are running these labs? Did your research and or the findings from your research sort of illuminate, you know, how much of a problem that issue is?
We can't put an exact number on it, but if you speak to women in science, if you speak to female grad students, female postdocs, female professors, a lot of them will have stories, sort of anecdotes about times they've run into men who were really didn't treat them as equals because of their gender.
Hmm. And Nancy Hopkins, I'm reading that young women today, even if they don't necessarily face the out-and-out sexism that at one time was pervasive in biology labs, that they still face, you know, what people are calling microaggressions, such as professors probably saying offhand that, you know, maybe we're not going to give you this assignment or this research project because women don't have as strong, I don't know, 3D spatial visualization skills or whatnot. How much does that matter?
It matters enormously. You know, I thought when I was young, oh, well, these kinds of things, which, of course, were even worse then, that doesn't matter. If you do a good enough experiment, of course you'll be recognized. I didn't understand that those aggressions and that kind of daily discrimination takes an enormous toll on women, and it's cumulative. And so it holds them back. It can prevent them from their work being acknowledged for being as good as it is. They don't get the same resources. So day in, day out, chip, chip, chip away. And, of course, it has a huge impact. And I think that this study is so important because it's one of these things which is kind of invisible. You know, you see all these women in biology, you think, oh, there's no problem there. But there, where it really matters, which is rising through the ranks on your way up, you see that there is a problem.
Well, I'm wondering what you think this study reveals that if anything can be done in the nation's most elite laboratories, because the overall sort of system of application and getting into these labs is probably less formal than people might think. So is there any concerted way to sort of break down the barriers?
I think that absolutely. I think this study puts the burden of proof on the universities. I think they now have to go and find out what's going on and, you know, find out. Are women applying and not being accepted, women of equal accomplishment? And if so, then, of course, they've got to fix it because that would be just blatant discrimination. What are the reasons? They have to find out. And I also think that the suggestion that Jason and his colleague made in the paper that these successful men have to actively recruit outstanding women that they're going to mentor into these positions. Because, you know, we see the huge impact that these men can have. You know, Jim Watson had on me and Joan Stites. There's a man named Joe Gall who's famous for having mentored the Nobel Prize winner, Elizabeth Blackburn, and many other great women scientists. So a small number of these powerful people can create hugely successful women scientists.
And especially I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I think that's what I wanted to say. You know, there's two things. The university has to find out what the reason is, and individual men need to look at this data very seriously and say, you know, okay, I want to get the best people in my lab. If they're not applying, what am I doing wrong? And how can I go and find some and recruit them to my lab?
Right, and especially as we noted at the beginning of this segment, where in places half, if not more, of the available pool in terms of undergraduates or graduate students are women already. Well, Nancy Hopkins, molecular biologist and professor emerita at MIT, such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Jason Schelzer, graduate student in biology at MIT and co-author of a new study on the gender gap in the nation's top biology labs. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, author Tom Perata on his novel The Leftovers, the basis of a new TV series on HBO, which premiered this past Sunday. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.